The guy, he walks up to him, the guy's lying on the ground, and he pops him in the head and executes him. Then he takes out a camera, takes pictures of both guys, gets back in his car, tries to drive away, and is captured by traffic cops who took him into the station to the police, where he's arrested for charged with double murder. There's a tape of him being interviewed by the cops that was done either inadvertently or surreptitiously. It's done from the floor, and you can hear him telling them that he works out of the consulate, and he's asking for water. He's very calm, amazingly calm for somebody who's just been through this, just killed two guys, and you know, been in a mob that rescued from a mob that was really angry at him, and everything. Totally calm, but he's saying he works at the Lahore consulate. So then, at that point, the other thing that happened is a SUV came racing with guys apparently from the same house that were with him, racing the wrong way down a street to get to him. They see the mob and the police, and they quickly jump the center line and try to race away and run over some poor pedestrian guy with a bicycle and kill him, and race to the consulate where they're safe. And they're never identified. The police tried to have the embassy turn them in for, you know, investigation and arrest, and they are flown out of by the U.S. without ever being identified. Turns out that those guys and Davis are now all being identified by the U.S. To papers like the New York Times and the Washington Post as CIA contractors. Pakistan's in an uproar, obviously, and then to make matters worse, it turns out that the two guys that were killed are members of Pakistani intelligence who were tailing Davis, and the Pakistani press is reporting that he was not only CIA connected, but that he was had way crossed the line beyond intelligence and was dealing with terrorist organizations in Pakistan. This is where it gets really crazy. On his cell, the thing that isn't reported, there's a lot not being reported in the U.S. press, by the way, on this.
How come I'm not surprised?
The Times and the Post and several other major news organizations, according to the British Guardian, had the information that he was CIA as early as a day or two after the shooting, but never reported it until it was widely known in the foreign press, including The Guardian, which confirmed it based on U.S. and Pakistan sources. But here's the thing that really got me. You recall on the 15th of February, the U.S. has been doing a full-court press to try to force Pakistan to release him, claiming he has diplomatic immunity as an embassy employee. But he's not an embassy employee. He was clearly he told the cops, and it was clear from his documentation when he was arrested that he was working for the consulate. And that's I'll go to that in a minute. That's a real important distinction. But at any rate, Obama got on the air at a press conference and said that he was our diplomat, and he used those words, and that Pakistan needs to release him. And then he lectured Pakistan on the law of embassy immunity, and saying that it's a longstanding, you know, thing that all countries adhere to, including the United States. I got a hold of a State Department document that's called Guidelines for Law Enforcement and Judicial Authorities Regarding Immunity, and it very clearly states that consular workers do not have immunity, and that cops should feel free to arrest them when they think they committed a crime, and judges should feel free to hold them without bail and convict them. So, you know, we have a double double standard here. Surprise, surprise. But you know, so Pakistanis are furious. But here's the thing: Obama was lying when he called him our diplomat, because he surely was not a diplomat. And even if he was working out of the U.S. embassy, driving around with the amount of armaments that were found in his car and other appurtenances of a spy, is not a diplomat by any stretch of the imagination. And so Obama was caught in a lie, but the major press in the U.S. knew it, and they allowed him to get away with saying that without any caveats. So they became propaganda organs in promoting his lie knowingly, because they had the information that he was a CIA spook. But it's worse than a spook, because, you know, here's the thing. In his car, and this has never been reported in the U.S. press, except on our journal, is that he had in his car, found by the police, multiple semi-automatic pistols, a Glock and a Beretta, with high-capacity clips, multiple high-capacity clips loaded. He also had buckets of bullets that were killer bullets that are illegal in Pakistan, high-velocity bored-out, mm-hmm. Hollow point and stuff like that. So he clearly was gunning for killing people with the stuff he had in his car. But he also had a little telescope. He had an infrared,
night vision,
forehead-mounted flashlight,
mm-hmm.
that's used for illuminating things that you can then pick up with a infrared rangefinder on your gun. So that's for night work, nasty night work. He had maps. He had a special GPS thing that's being used for targeting drones, finding targets and labeling them for drones. He had, and this is the really spooky one, he had a camera. The camera he used to take pictures of the two guys he assassinated had on it a whole bunch of pictures of Pakistani military installations, bunkers, on the Indian border, on the Pakistan border, and also madrasas and mosques around, and other schools, a Montessori school around Lahore. And these are things that are being targeted by terrorist bombings all the time in Pakistan. So you got to say, what is this guy doing with these kinds of targets in his camera? He was driving around taking pictures of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found he had multiple cell phones and also satellite phones in the car too, wire clippers, extra batteries, the kinds of things you use for making bomb detonators, and masks and makeup.
Oh boy,
this is not a diplomat, dude. And then the other thing was that on his on his cell phones, they found 33 calls to leading Pakistani Taliban officials, and also to people in this other group called Lashkar-e-Jhangvi, which is a U.S. and Pakistani identified terror organization that has been linked to both the Mumbai bombing and also to the execution of the Wall Street Journal reporter David Pearl. So he's in contact with these guys, and what the Pakistani and Indian papers are reporting, again not being reported in our U.S. press so-called, is that the Pakistani authorities believe that he's actually been orchestrating terror attacks by these organizations. And they claim the goal is to increase the terrorist activity in Pakistan so that the Pakistanis will get worried about the safety of their nuclear facilities and allow the U.S. to come in and secure them militarily. Other people think that it, and I'm one of these, I think that's a little obscure. I think that it's designed to destabilize Pakistan and justify a military coup to oust the civilian government. The U.S. is a lot more comfortable, as you know,
mm-hmm.
working with military governments than with messy democracies.
Mm-hmm.
So well, at any rate, you wonder why would the U.S. be going to such extraordinary lengths of sending over, Kerry, a couple of congresspeople, Gates, Hillary Clinton, and then having the president actually get out on a limb and lie in public to pressure Pakistan. They're threatening. They've already canceled a visit by the president of Pakistan, Zardari, over this. They've canceled a visit to Pakistan by the president. They're threatening to withdraw aid from Pakistan. And this is all over a low-level CIA contractor. You got to say, what are they worried about to that extent? And I would say that, I think the fear is that they think that he'll be put on the rack, you know, thumb screws, waterboarding, all the things that our government does so well, and that he'll squeal about the fact that we have an active terror campaign that we sponsor in Pakistan, that the war on terror then becomes a joke because we're playing both sides of it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, the latest I heard is that the actual trial, but he was in court today or yesterday in Pakistan.
Yeah, he was refusing to sign the criminal complaint.
So the proceedings have started.
Right. They're not, you know, I have a Pakistani journalist I've been in touch with who's a former brigadier in the Pakistani military, and Shaukat Qadir, and he wrote a piece for our paper on the internal politics of Pakistan, which also is a context that's totally missing in the U.S. media. But the point he made is he doesn't see how Davis can avoid a trial, because he said that it's in the Lahore and Punjabi court, and Punjab, as he pointed out to me, is the only state of Pakistan that's in the hands of the opposition party, which is led by a former leader of Pakistan. And that party has no gain from letting him go. In fact, by trying him, they put more pressure on Zardari, because Zardari, as he says, is a puppet of the U.S., and he's doomed if he lets the guy go, because public sentiment is running like 99% to 1 against releasing Davis. You know, another problem is for Davis is that a 18-year-old girl who was 6 months ago married to one of the guys he killed was so distraught that she took rat poison and killed herself. But when she was in the hospital dying, she was interviewed by Pakistani reporters, and she said she despaired of having justice for her husband and was killing herself. So she becomes a martyr. There's huge demonstrations saying that he killed her, too. How does Zardari release her without creating an Egypt situation?
Now, when you talk about the political party in Punjab, is that the one headed by Nawaz Sharif?
Yes.
Now, for some reason, I could never quite figure this out. Nawaz Sharif is a very rich guy. He's rather conservative, but for some reason, the U.S. does not like him. Even though he seems like a pretty competent guy, the U.S. is sticking with Zardari.
Sharif is a nationalist.
Oh, okay.
And, the U.S. doesn't like nationalists. They like puppets.
And Zardari is certainly a well-strung puppet.
Zardari fits the mold of what the U.S. basically likes. He's basically a crook who is profiteering on his power there and, you know, lining his pockets.
Mr. 10%, I believe.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that's right. And the other thing is that Shaukat Qadir told me was that the legal profession and the judges have no love for Zardari. If you remember, there was in 2009 and 2008, there was this long insurrection, really, by the legal profession to defend the court system against the Pakistani government. And they eventually got what they wanted, which was a fair amount of independence from the government. But they really have no love right up through the Supreme Court for the central government. So to think that the courts will cave on this is a pipe dream. You know, they, as he put it, the Supreme Court is rolling up its sleeves getting ready to take this case.
Oh, boy. You know, there's another politician who's very popular, who's really not mentioned in this case, but that's the former cricket star Imran Khan.
Yep, and he's spoken out saying that this guy should be tried, too. So, you know, all the popular figures are lining up behind the popular sentiment that he should face trial.
The U.S. is stuck with Mr. 10%, so that kind of leaves the military.
Yeah, no. Mm-hmm. And so, I think even the military would be afraid to spring him because mm-hmm. of the popular sentiment is so strong, running so strong against him. So this is a huge blow up. But for us, you know, in America, I mean, we should be outraged, A, that our media has covered this up, B, that our country is sponsoring terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, well, I understand that the U.S. and the Pakistani military had a little meeting recently in Oman, sort of getting there, trying to plot strategy or something.
Yeah, well, I think they're going to try for a coup. That's uh-huh. my guess. I mean, the best hope for Ray Davis to get out is a coup.
Boy.
And short of that, I don't see how he gets released because mm-hmm. the public sentiment's running so strong. And even a coup is questionable if it releases him because the public anger is so great. And now it would be coming on the heels of all these liberation movements
oh, boy,
through
yeah.
the Arab world. So uh-huh. I don't even know whether the military is going to dare to take this on. You know, one of the things about Pakistan is that it has one thing in common with Egypt, and that is that I think what really made the success of the Egyptian people's rebellion was the fact that Egypt's army is a drafty army,
mm-hmm.
and that's true of Pakistan also.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much harder for the army to turn its guns on the people when it's the people who are in the army.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, most of the Arab governments have been very slick about how they staff their armies. For instance, in Jordan, the army is mostly Bedouin, and the population is mostly Palestinian, and the Bedouins hate the Palestinians, and mm-hmm. the Palestinians don't like the Bedouins. So for the Bedouins
like
the
king,
Palestinians,
too.
It's not very difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, they probably enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big massacre. It's called the Black September when the mm-hmm. The last king of Jordan turned his army on the Palestinians and slaughtered them. So, you know, that's how he does it. Libya, Gaddafi did it by using tribes and mm-hmm. having different tribes in different armies and keeping them at not trusting each other. In China, they do, where I used to live, the government has these battalions that are local, they're all the same, like local groups from different provinces that speak local dialects, and then they move them into other provinces to garrison them where they have little love for the
right.
people in the province they're in.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of standard.
And that was how they successfully mm-hmm. crushed the Tiananmen Square thing, is they pulled the Beijing garrison out, which had, you know, fraternized a lot with the locals for years, and brought in, you know, rural provincial soldiers who the Beijing people always look down on as hicks mm-hmm. and who, you know, therefore don't like the Beijingers. And
yeah.
so they were willing to crush it.
That's kind of standard practice for tyrannies, but I think we have a couple. Our number to call is 503-231-8187, and I believe we have a caller on the line. No, we don't. Oh, okay. But the phone lines are open. Okay, let's dispose of this thing about whether, you know, what the rules of diplomacy say, you know, the Vienna Convention.
That was such crap.
And get that out of the way.
I actually wrote a complaint to the Times ombudsman, and he told me I was right, and he passed it along to the foreign desk, and lo and behold, a week later, they ran what I had been saying, but of course without admitting that they'd been blowing it all along. The U.S. government keeps citing the Vienna Convention of 1961, which is on embassy relations, and that's for diplomats. Diplomats are people who have contact with government officials in the host country and actually are involved in diplomatic activity, negotiating and things. Consulates are something else, and there was a second convention passed in 1963 for consular relations, and they're totally different in terms of how they treat immunity. Diplomats who have to be designated as diplomats by both the embassy and ultimately by the defining definition is by the host country, have absolute immunity. They can't be handcuffed if they commit a crime. They have to be treated with dignity, and then they can't be tried. They can only be deported, which is why typically you have CIA people based in embassies and other countries base their spies in embassies, because then when they're caught, they can only be thrown out of the country. But Davis was in Lahore and was, you know, a contractor, so he wasn't even actually an employee of the embassy, as we define employees. And more importantly, on the 20th of January, as it does every year, the U.S. submitted a list of its embassy staff to the Foreign Office of Pakistan, that's their State Department, saying these are the people that are our embassy employees, and it had 48 people on it, and Davis was not one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And then a day after he was arrested for this double murder, they submitted an amended list.
Okay.
And Davis's name was added to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then and the other thing they did that was kind of funny was he was caught carrying a regular U.S. passport with a regular visa, multiple entry visa, but so obviously he was posing as a civilian person on his passport. After he was arrested, the embassy rushed over a day later, or the consulate rather rushed over a day later and said, "Oh, we have a diplomatic passport for him." It was a shiny new passport, you know. saying diplomat, and you know, they said, "Well, we'd like to swap this for the old tattered one he
has."
That's
pretty obvious, and, you know.
Yeah, so you know, as my friend Shaukat Qadir said, "What do they think we are in Pakistan? Stupid."
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it was so badly done,
and
even the embassy, even the State Department said he was a consular employee initially, and then they corrected themselves and said, "Oh, he's an embassy employee."
Boy.
Well, the difference is the consular employees are only entitled to immunity for official acts that they're performing.
And that's
now,
not
Davis,
murder.
Davis was said to be a security person whose job was protecting consular officials. That's what they said. But he was driving in a civilian car, rental car, by himself with all these arms and odd things in the car. He was not on official business, at least what they were saying was his official business, and the business that he was on, while it may have been official for the CIA, was not official embassy business.
Right. Well, I think we do have another caller on the line now. Jack's on the line. Hi, welcome to KABU.
Hi, Jack.
Thanks for doing this show. This is the kind of thing that that needs to be done a lot, because this global war of terror has been covered up so seriously for, you know, ever since it was launched with the big one, 9/11, and the work you're doing, I think, is great. I think all journalists working out in the field should be encouraged to really blow the lid off of this thing, and all the related things. You know, it goes. I mean, the stuff has been. It creeps into the mainstream media little by little from time to time. They can't keep it out sometimes. If you recall the British special agents in Basra about 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's very similar, right?
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Yeah, brought back memories.
You remember
right.
those guys were actually picked up wearing Arab garb, and their car was full of bombs materials, and they were arrested because Britain had just turned over sovereignty to the local police authorities in Basra. So they arrested these guys, and the British actually attacked the police station to free them because they were going to expose this exact kind of stuff, that the Brits and the Americans were bombing stuff to sow discord between the Sunnis and the Shias.
Yeah, now this one is quite serious. There was a report in a Russian in the Russian news. I don't know if you read that.
Yeah, I did.
That this guy was involved with trying to get some nuclear materials into the hands of terrorists on the insurgents on the border. And that sounds really out there, but nevertheless, I don't know. What do you think of that?
I think I have lost faith in the Russian media on this stuff. There's been a lot of heavy breathing stuff coming out of the Russian media for years that hasn't held up. So I'm staying clear of that one. But you know, my feeling is there was no evidence presented for that. And so what I'm sticking with is what I'm reading and hearing was found in his car or on his phone that would, give you hard evidence of what he was connected with. But clearly he was in intimate contact with leaders of both the Pakistani Taliban and with this terror group that killed Daniel Pearl. And that's bad enough,
Yeah, it's pretty serious. The whole thing is just so rotten, and the media has covered it so badly. Another one that I point to from time to time. We've got a show trial coming up. They've had some scenes already, but the rest of it's yet to be played out with KSM in New York. And you probably know this, but the South Asian Times reported at the time that he was supposedly picked up that he was killed in the raid, in that what they've got is a patsy. And this guy, of course, will say anything they want, but, you know, torture him, and that looks good. That's part of the theater. the whole thing, it really needs to be blown up. And thanks for the work you're doing there.
Hey, thanks for the call.
Okay. Now, one thing I didn't mention was my initial story. What turned me on to this story about Raymond Davis was the initial report said that he worked for a company called Hyperion Protective Services, and so or consultants. And so I looked that company up, and I found a website that listed a headquarters in Orlando, Florida. And, you know, it was just amazing how it worked out. But I used Google Earth to find the address, and it happened to be on a street that, they do those side shots of.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at it from, on a side view, and it was a vacant strip mall. So I went across the street with Google and found a building across the street that identified it as a drug rehab services place and halfway house. So I called their number, and a really nice guy offered to go across the street and check it out for me. So he goes over to the address, and he comes back and calls me, and he says it's an empty storefront, but it has a rental agency number on it. And I called the rental agency, and they said that it had been vacant for 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So this is the address that they were listing on the website for his company.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to the Secretary of State's office in Florida, they said it had been delisted for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a sham company from the start. You know, it never had any business. It was a joke. So clearly, this guy was, set up. Probably the Times has him being 10 years as a special forces guy till 2003, and then working for Blackwater. I suspect that he either is still working for Blackwater. He had a ID card on him that the police found that listed him as a DOD contractor, which would be, a Blackwater thing. But I talked to a special forces guy who told me he believes he's probably active duty special forces, and he told me that there's a lot of special forces guys who, for public consumption, get cashiered out of the military, but actually stay in special forces with their records being kept only at their unit level and not mm-hmm. at the Pentagon level.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that those guys are by the thousands are placed in, countries around the world undercover and operate under the direction of the Defense Department.
Wow.
So that would be another reason the U.S. would be freaking out over this guy, because that is, a huge violation of diplomatic rules.
Mm-hmm.
Soldiers, first of all, have to be in uniform by, mm-hmm. by, you know, Geneva Convention.
Or else they're terrorists.
Yeah, or else they're terrorists, and bingo, you know. And that's what it is. So, it's just unbelievable. Americans need to know that this country is a leading, probably the leading terrorist-sponsoring country in the world.
Okay, I think this is KBOO Portland, and we are talking with David Lindorf, who is the founding editor of an internet newspaper, online newspaper called I Can't Believe This Is Happening.
No, not I can't. Just this can't be happening.
This can't be happening. Okay.
And I urge people to go to it and check it out.
Right.
We need readers and we need support.
Okay, do that. So you just type in what?
This can't be happening.net with no apostrophe in the can.
I see. Okay. And
one word.
And we have a caller on the line. Thomas, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Pierre. Good morning, Mr. Lindorf.
Good morning, Thomas.
I want to echo the sentiments of the previous caller. I think you're performing a real public service as being central in exposing this particular incident and indeed other similar stories that go to the heart of the U.S. Security apparatus that are just not being covered or outright distorted in the mainstream. And, you know, I just think this is very important because hopefully people are beginning to realize that, you know, that there's a really deep story here that has to do with the fundamental way of how U.S. foreign policy is really conducted and what role such a people as this Mr. Davis actually play. And you know, it's interesting. If you go back and look, there's a whole line of dissident former CIA officials, many of them with decades of service, people who were field operatives at very high levels, people who worked as analysts at different levels, you know, including the late Philip Agee, Mr. John Stockwell, Ralph McGeehee, Victor Machetti, and the list goes on. And what's interesting
don't forget
is
Ray McGovern.
Oh, indeed, who was just
beaten
arrested.
Up by Hillary's goons.
Indeed, was just arrested for exercising quietly and peacefully his free speech rights at a Hillary Clinton talk, ironically, about freedom of expression.
That's right.
Right.
At any rate, you know, I guess what I'm thinking is that, you know, there's usually three layers of cover story when something like this happens, when there's a beginning of a crack in the armor of the cover story about these sort of clandestine operations, you know, and on the surface, if you talk about CNN and the mainstream media and the normal daily newspapers, you get this story that, well, this is an aberration, this is an exception, this is nothing mm-hmm. normal, this doesn't define U.S. policy. Basically, the narrative is, you know, not much to see here, move along.
Right.
And then just beneath that, sort of at the little bit more of the elite-level press, you know, your New York Times, your Atlantic Monthly, and also talk shows such as Charlie Rose on PBS, You get statements that, well, you know, this is real politique. This is the world's sort of a grimy place, and there's not a lot of perfect actors out there.
It's a jungle out there.
Yes, yeah, so it's the idea that, you know, this is just the reality, sort of a Machiavellian sort of cover. This is a, you know, we don't really want to do this, but there's not clean actors. And then just beneath that, when you start, there's another level of narrative that comes out. And people who are often dissidents that revolve in the State Department, military intelligence, and people who do write the books, and they say, look, this is not, you know, I worked there. We worked there at the CIA. We worked in the Pentagon, in the DIA. This is standard operating procedure. This is the way it's done. It's not that there weren't good guys there we could work at. More often than not, work with in these countries, the good guys were the targets. And indeed, people who are drug, you know, people who are drug smugglers of Afghanistan, people who are the thugs who crush the labor unions in El Salvador. This is the way it's done. But I think what's really frightening today is the fact that there's this nexus between for-profit mercenary corporations, the CIA, the DIA, and other establishments. So I mean, really, particularly since Bush. Junior, but also going back to Clinton, there's just been this massive privatization. So now you have this incredible labyrinth of these revolving doors between private for-profit entities and the Defense Department, and it creates these characters like Mr. Davis who it's almost impossible to track them down. And my only hope is that now this may be a very rare object lesson, and I only hope that Mr. Davis Webb comes out, exposes more the true subterfuge and a duplicity of U.S. foreign policy. And really, in fact, it's cynicism and the cynicism of the policy. And anyway, I should cut it short, but thank you very much again, sir, for your important work in this area. Yeah.
Thanks for
the call.
Well, I agree
with everything you said. I would add something to what you said, Thomas, and that is that people need to realize it goes beyond foreign policy, because when you start having this kind of activity by the U.S. government in its foreign actions, you know, with promoting, sponsoring, organizing terrorism, it has a almost guaranteed result of coming home, because these guys come home. I mean, these are that we've got apparently, you know, hundreds and even thousands of these contractors who are engaging in complete utter lawlessness with impunity on behalf of the U.S. government. They come back to the U.S. And that's how they operate. And increasingly, we have this creeping sort of fascism in the U.S. that's going to end up employing these guys, and that the techniques that we find acceptable for overseas are migrating back to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the, you know, even greater risk, I think. That
I got a little housekeeping announcement now. This is KBOO. We're talking David Lindorf and about the fair in Pakistan. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on One Land, Many Voices, Peter Miller of Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights talks about the local initiative to expand business ties between Oregon and Israel. And then journalist Eric Reuter talks about prospects for just peace in Israel-Palestine. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. Her guests include Portland musician David Rovics. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Melinda Bernard and Kurt Lauer host a pilot episode of Beyond Normal. And their guest is ghost hunter Ross Ellison. And now this is a bit of a diversion, but one a previous caller mentioned John Stockwell. This is something I've been wondering about for quite a while, because John Stockwell has been very silent now for I don't know how many years. And about 15 years ago, he came to Portland. He gave a talk at a local church. And I wasn't there, but I understand people who were there said he seemed very agitated. And in his speech, he talked about how everything he previously said about the CIA was wrong. And then he just kind of, people kind of got a little aroused by that. And then he kind of took off pretty quickly after his speech was over. And I've never been able to find out exactly what's going on here. So if there's anybody listening who was at that speech, will they please contact me, write me care of KBOO. You can do that care of the website. Or David Lindorf, maybe you could investigate that. What's up with John Stockwell?
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that he was backtracking on his very well-documented exposés of the CIA.
Apparently, and this happened, I think, about 15 or 20 years ago. And it just and since then, he's been you haven't really heard anything from him. But anyway, you know, we were talking earlier about this meeting between the U.S. and Pakistani armies, and according to one story, they are sort of coming up with a solution where Pakistan will turn over Raymond Davis to the U.S., and the U.S. promises to investigate. And then there'll be compensation to the families of the people who were killed.
And yeah, what a joke. The U.S. will investigate.
Boy, yes.
It is pretty ugly. I mean, you know, the U.S. First of all, there was a report that the families of the three victims, because, you know, there was the victim, actually four victims. There was the victim killed by the SUV that was rushing to Davis's aid. And then there's Davis's two execution victims, and then there's the young woman who committed suicide. All the families of those four people have been reported that they've been offered green cards and money without saying who was offering it. Guess. They all turned it down. There was also a case just a couple days ago where the father of one of the people, I can't remember whether it was the girl or one of the two guys that was shot, was offered money, you know, because they have a tradition in Pakistan and many Muslim countries of paying blood money for deaths in the way that, you know, comes out of the tribal culture where to avoid a Hatfields and McCoys situation, you can pay off the death of a Klan member and then everything's fine again. I forget the Pakistani term, the Urdu term for it, but at any rate, it's a pretty long-standing tradition in Muslim cultures, and they were this family was offered money. The father refused it, and three men attacked him and forced poison down his throat.
Yes,
They were trying to eliminate him from the picture in hopes that the family would then take the money. It seems a little self, you know, sort of counterproductive. But at any rate, he survived. He was rushed to the hospital, and they pumped his stomach out, and he lived. But, you know, they're leaning pretty hard on these families to accept payments, and that would get Davis out. Whether that was the U.S. instigated or Zardari instigated as a way of getting him out of the predicament he's in, I can't say, but it doesn't make that much difference which one of them was trying to do it. There was another interesting twist where some Pakistanis, I think Zardari and his party, was pushing the idea that there be a trade for the woman Siddiqui, you know,
That
was got this horrible conviction, 86 years for allegedly trying to kill her two special forces captors. She, this tiny woman who was supposedly being interrogated as a possible terrorist, and she's being interrogated by two big special forces guys, and she, and they claimed that she grabbed one of their M16s from them and tried to shoot them. She didn't hit them, if in fact she even did what they said, and there's some question as to whether this even happened, but it's hard to imagine it. Really.
I know.
I mean, these guys don't just let go of their gun, and she's just a little woman. A physician, and so anyway, she ended up going, you know, getting convicted on some of the charges, and the judge
got this
New
long,
York
long sentence.
Years. So, and in Pakistan, she's a national hero,
right?
Because they everybody there realizes it was a kangaroo court, and so Zardari came up with this brilliant idea of, well, let's swap her for Davis, and Siddiqui's family uniformly rejected it and said, you know, we don't want the money for that. She's not going to be bought. And so, you know, I mean, I assume she agrees with that.
We've got another caller on the line now. So Mitchell is on the line. Hi, you're on
Mitchell.
The air.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hello.
Interesting subject here. It's a shame what's going on over there in Pakistan. But we all have to agree that our government wouldn't lie, okay? They wouldn't lie to us or the Pakistanis. But closer to home, something that's been at my craw for a while, I haven't heard any real investigation or any in-depth. But here recently we had that Officer Dodd shooting. Gentlemen, recall that?
Oh, the guy down on the coast, you mean?
Right.
Well, what's that guy? This is kind of a little bit off topic, I think, isn't it?
A little bit off topic, but it has to do basically with, is that a false flag that happened down there?
I think it's pretty unrelated, and also I think you're being ironic when you say our government wouldn't lie to us.
Well, I'm being sarcastic.
Of course. Well, I think the Officer Dodd thing, I think that's really unrelated to what we're talking about, but thanks for your call anyway. Yeah, I understand that the, did we mention this before, that apparently Davis is being kept very securely guarded because the Pakistani authorities are afraid the U.S. might try and poison him.
That's right.
There's no physical contact between, you know, the embassy can visit him, but there's always a big glass screen between them. And I think his guards are unarmed or something like that. They're really afraid that this guy will be knocked off.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely right, because that would be another solution for the U.S. To sort of cleanly wipe the slate and get rid of him.
But that, who would they blame? I mean, that's just blame the terrorists or something? I mean, this is crazy. Guess.
Yeah, yeah, they could, if they can get a Pakistani to do it, then they can blame, you know, some, you know, passionate member of the Pakistani population didn't think he'd get tried and executed, so they did it themselves. Or
you know that, and as you know, that is not too hard to do for our listeners. That you know, say if the U.S. has some so-called terror group where they have an arrangement with a leader of that group, you know, then this is how false flag operations happen. And so the leader of the group tells one of his subordinates to do this or that. Now, the subordinate thinks that he is doing something against the empire, you know, against U.S. And but it's so he is acting in good faith according to his beliefs. It's the leader of the group that has been, bought out by the U.S. That's how these false flag operations happen.
And well, and obviously, if Davis is in contact with 33 or so of the leaders of these two outfits that do conduct terrorism, both of which have infiltrated the police departments and stuff, it would not be difficult for those people who've already been compromised to turn on one of their people inside the prison or inside the police force to do that kind of a thing. So, I mean, I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility at all that he would be offed. I think it's less likely that they would be able to bust him out of prison. That would be a
well. The Brits had it. I think the British in Iraq that incident. They actually blasted a hole in the jail with the tanks or something.
Right, but that was just a police station holding cell.
Yeah,
it was one little police station. This is the main prison in Lahore, and it's a like huge structure. It would be pretty difficult for the U.S. to man up a operation that could bust him out of there.
I don't see how the U.S. gets out of this. It seems like every possible move would just get them in deeper.
No, the easiest one would be the one you just suggested. It would be doing him in, and it would get blamed on a local outfit.
So, where do you think this? Do you have any venture, any guess as to what's going to happen? I mean, the proceedings have started.
Well, your first step is going to be a hearing on his immunity, and that's where we'll, you know, it may go on for a long time because, you know, at first of it, it'll be decided at the Lahore court level, and whatever way it goes, it's going to end up getting appealed up to the Supreme Court in Pakistan. And if my journalist friend in Pakistan is right, the Supreme Court will reject immunity just because, if nothing else, they want to embarrass and put Zardari on the spot. I don't see how Zardari can get him out unless they pull something like a swap for Siddiqui or something, and try to win local points for that. But then, you know, you got the second problem is I'm not even sure that the U.S. could release her because they've spent so much time telling Americans what a horrible woman she is. Can they order the courts, a federal court, to release him or release her? I don't know. I mean, you know, 86 years means she's a serious terrorist threat in the minds of the average American. So then you're going against what you told Americans. And so I don't know. The U.S. is really in a box on this pretty seriously. That's not to say they can't get out of it, but I'm sure this was not in the plan.
It's really amazing how one incident can, you know, it's sort of almost, in a way, it's like this one guy in Tunisia sets himself on fire and sort of starts his chain reaction. And here one guy, you know, kind of loses cool or something, and look what's happening.
Yeah, he either lost his cool or there was something deeper going on, you know, in terms of whether he felt compromised because they had spotted him and he realized he was being followed, and that was the end of his cover, so he had to get rid of them and thought he could get away. I don't know exactly what was going on. It's hard to believe a guy who spent 10 years in Special Forces would lose his cool.
Yeah, yeah.
I suspect there's something else going on. I mean, this is a guy, especially if you listen, if you go to our website, thiscan'tbehappening.net, and go down to the bottom of the homepage, there I have a YouTube of the actual interview of him in the prison with the cops. And just listen to his voice. And, you know, I just found it really, like, frightening and mind-blowing to listen to the calmness of his voice as he's asking for a bottle of water and kibitzing mm-hmm. with the cops after having just blown these two guys away. It's you know, it's a psychopath when you listen. Because,
yeah, did he
know,
think
nobody, nobody can kill two guys like that in cold blood, execute them with shots to the head. They were shot in the back, by the mm-hmm. way, which is another thing the U.S. didn't report when they were. The U.S. was claiming that he felt threatened, that they were robbers, and he felt threatened. But they mm-hmm. were shot in the back and then executed, and they certainly weren't threatening him when they were lying on the ground with four or five bullet holes placed neatly in the right places.
Wow! And this happened in the middle of the day.
Middle of the day, busy business section of Lahore.
And he seemed to think he could get away with it.
Yeah, yeah. He made a dash in his car and uh-huh. thought he was going to get away, but people blocked it. Uh-huh. And then, you know, they busted in the back window. The cops came up to the car, told him to get out. He said no because he thought the people would tear him apart. And one of the traffic cops decided that he was right, told him to move over to the other seat, got in himself in the car, and drove him to the prison. Mm-hmm. To the police station, rather, where wow. he was arrested. So it was a pretty dramatic scene, but he apparently got down the street considerably in his car and thought he was going to get away.
Boy.
You know, I mean, it would take a lot. If you saw somebody, I mean, imagine a U.S. street scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
A guy shoots through his windshield at two guys on motorcycles, and knocks both of them off the bike. I mean, if you look at his the picture, I've also got on my site, one of the stories has a picture of the front windshield with the bullet holes. There's a nice tight pattern where he fired this semi-automatic and got off eight rounds and hit these guys. I mean, this guy is an incredible marksman to shoot through a windshield and hit these guys. And then, you know, so you're getting this bang, 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 bang. These two guys fall down. One gets up and starts to run. He pops him in the back and gets him. And then he walks over to the other guy, pops him in the head and kills him. And if you imagine that on a New York street, how many people do you think would be within 100 yards of that site at that point?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, you see somebody doing that, you run as fast as you can run. So I'm sure that the scene had cleared pretty well by the time he got back in his car after taking the pictures, and then he takes off. But then the interesting thing is how Pakistanis reacted to that. They got in the street and blocked his car.
Wow, hey, crime fighters.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I'm not sure you'd see Americans get in front of a car like that. But they simply, the crush of people stopped his car. Then they started pounding on the car.
Mm-hmm.
And that's amazing, too, when you think he still has the guns.
Wow.
I think we're
going to have to end it here. This is a story that's not going to go away for a while. We were talking with David Lindorf, who is the editor of the online newspaper This Can't Be Happening, and I really recommend that people look up that newspaper and follow this story as it proceeds. So I'd like to thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Per, for having me on.
And I think we will continue looking into this. And stay tuned, folks, because One Land, Many Voices is coming right up. So this is KBOO, your radio station.
So long.
Dave.